From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
And there's no such thing as a substandard wage because it's accepted voluntarily. Obviously, Walmart is improving the life of anybody who says, yes, I would like the job.
Why Walmart works and why that drives some people crazy. Or is it Walmart, the high cost of low price?
Why is it that a corporation that in 2003 had an outstanding $240 billion in sales would not provide a livable wage and affordable health care for their employees?
There's nowhere around that there's a company that makes this much money and still turns around and makes their associates go to the state for aid.
We look at two films on Walmart and the movement that's building against one of the world's most powerful companies. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In an important development in the growing congressional debate over the U.S. occupation of Iraq, a hawkish Democrat who voted to authorize the war has introduced a bill calling for the immediate withdrawal of U.S. troops. This is Democratic Congressmember John Murtha of Pennsylvania.
It's time for a change in direction. Our military is suffering. The future of our country is at risk. We cannot continue on the present course. It is evident that continued military action in Iraq is not in the best interest of the United States of America, the Iraqi people, or the Persian Gulf region.
Pennsylvania Congressmember John Murtha speaking on Thursday. He's an Army veteran with close ties to military commanders. He's also the top Democrat on the House Appropriations Defense Subcommittee and has visited Iraq several times since the invasion began. Murtha's proposed bill reads in part, quote, "The deployment of U.S. forces in Iraq by direction of Congress is hereby terminated, and the forces involved are to be redeployed at the earliest practicable date." The bill marks the first time a resolution has been submitted to Congress for calling on immediate withdrawal from Iraq. In response, White House spokesperson Scott McClellan said, quote, "Congressman Murtha is a respected veteran and politician who has a record of supporting a strong America, so it's baffling that he's endorsing the policy positions of Michael Moore and the extreme liberal wing of the Democratic Party." Although Murtha joins a growing list of pro-war Democrats who have reversed their positions, Democratic congressional leaders distance themselves from his stance. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi said, quote, "Mr. Murtha speaks for himself," while Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid added, quote, "I don't support immediate withdrawal." Meanwhile, in Iraq, separate bombing attacks have killed at least 60 people. Earlier today, two suicide bombers attacked a Shiite mosque in the town of Qanaqin near the Iranian border. At least 52 people were reported killed. In Baghdad, two car bombs exploded outside the Hamra Hotel, killing at least 8 people and wounding over 40 others. The Hamra is a popular place among foreign journalists. U.S. and Iraqi officials have announced a broad inquiry into prison conditions at detention centers across the country. The announcement follows the discovery Sunday of over 170 prisoners in the basement of an Interior Ministry compound. Iraqi officials insisted Thursday no more than 7 detainees showed signs of torture, but the U.S. government-run Voice of America broadcast service says at least a third of the detainees, quote, appeared severely emaciated, and many showed cuts and bruises on their faces, arms, and legs. One man was taken out of the compound on a stretcher because he was unable to walk. The detainees were transferred to the U.S.-run Abu Ghraib prison. Meanwhile, South Korea announced today it plans to withdraw one-third of its forces from Iraq in the next year. With over 3,000 troops in the country, South Korea maintains the third-largest foreign military presence in Iraq after the United States and Britain. The announcement appeared to take the Bush administration by surprise. A National Security Council spokesperson said, quote, "They have not informed the United States government of that." In Sri Lanka, Socialist Prime Minister Mahinda Rajapakse has won the country's presidential elections with just over 50% of the vote. Rajapakse beat his closest opponent by under 200,000 votes. The election was met with a widespread boycott in the country's northern Tamil region, where voting was virtually non-existent. The Washington Post is reporting the CIA has set up a joint counterterrorism centers with local intelligence agencies in more than two dozen countries. The Counterterrorist Intelligence Centers, or CTICs, conduct joint operations based on tips mostly provided by American intelligence. The network includes countries that have been criticized by the U.S. for human rights violations, such as Uzbekistan and Indonesia. The revelation comes as public outcry is growing in several countries around the world over the possible use of their airports for the so-called rendition of CIA detainees. And peace activists in North Carolina are holding a protest at the time of this broadcast against a private airline company. Aero Contractors provides a fleet of charter jets and pilots to the CIA for transporting detainees to foreign countries that practice torture in a practice the government calls extraordinary rendition. This is Andrew Wimmer of the Center for Theology and Social Analysis of St. Louis, one of the organizers of the North Carolina protest.
We're here at the Johnston County Airport, which is just outside of Smithfield, North Carolina. And we've just entered the property of Aero Contractors. They have a blue hangar here on the side of the municipal airport. And we're here to serve them with an indictment, charging them with violation of U.S. and international laws prohibiting torture.
Andrew Wimmer of the Center for Theology and Social Analysis in North Carolina. They have entered the premises of Aero Contractors, which they contend provides a fleet of charter jets and pilots to the CIA. Congressional officials announced Thursday the Pentagon will investigate the pre-war activities of one of the war's key architects. The Office of the Pentagon's Inspector General says they'll comply with a Senate request to review the intelligence activities of former U.S. Defense Undersecretary Douglas Feith. The investigation will focus on whether Feith gave the White House uncorroborated evidence to support the case for invasion in the lead up to war. A new indictment has led to the disclosure. The U.S. government hired a convicted felon to oversee over $80 million in reconstruction money in Iraq. Robert Stein was charged this week with accepting kickbacks and bribes while working as a financial officer for the Coalition Provisional Authority. Prosecutors say Stein received at least $200,000 a month for his role in steering reconstruction contracts to U.S. businessman Philip Bloom. Bloom was charged with several offenses on Wednesday. A court filing says Stein used money earmarked for Iraqi library and police facilities to buy cars, property, and jewelry for himself and his wife. According to the New York Times, Stein was hired as a controller for the U.S. Occupation Authority despite having served a prison sentence in the mid-90s for fraud. A Florida construction company also says it fired Stein in 2002 after it was discovered he'd falsified invoices and payroll records. The New York Times is reporting a new government study has found the military is falling far behind in recruiting goals for key combat positions in Iraq and Afghanistan. The Government Accountability Office says the military has failed to staff 41% of combat and non-combat specialist positions. The report says the shortfall was disguised by the overstaffing of other positions in order to meet overall recruiting goals. Derek Stewart, the GAO's Director of Military Personnel, commented, quote, "The aggregate recruiting numbers are rather meaningless. For Congress and this nation to truly understand what's happening with the all-volunteer force and its ability to recruit and retain highly qualified people, you have to drill down into occupational specialties. And when you do, it's very revealing," he said. On Capitol Hill earlier today, the House narrowly approved a budget measure that cuts funding for programs for the poor, for college students, and for farmers. The $50 billion cost-cutting plan passed by just two votes. The Washington Post reports the House measure would cut about 220,000 people off food stamps, allow states to impose new costs on Medicaid beneficiaries, squeeze student lenders, cut aid to state child support enforcement programs, and trim farm supports. Meanwhile, the Senate passed a $60 billion tax bill that includes a $4 billion tax penalty on oil companies. That penalty has drawn the threat of a veto from the White House. Senate Democrats failed to add an amendment that would have imposed a 50% tax on certain oil profits if those profits were not reinvested in increasing the country's energy supplies. On Thursday, dissenting Republicans joined with Democratic House colleagues to defeat a major GOP health and education spending measure. Democrats had criticized the bill for ending more than 20 existing programs and preventing 8 others from being introduced. The cuts include $900 million in funding for federal disease control and $8 billion towards preparing for a potential flu pandemic. And in South Korea, thousands of protesters demonstrated outside the APEC summit in the port city of Busan today. Police used water cannons and barricades to hold back protesters chanting slogans against President Bush, who is there meeting with 20 other Asia-Pacific leaders. Demonstrators burned an effigy of Bush attached with the slogan, "No APEC, no Bush." Police said they've assembled a security force of up to 46,000 officers for a protest expected to reach 30,000 people. Rallies have taken place all week in the lead-up to summit. Earlier this week, 2 Korean farmers committed suicide in protest of the South Korean plans to lift trade barriers to foreign produce. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. The White House is bracing for a possible expansion of the CIA leak investigation that took down Vice President Cheney's chief of staff, Louis Scooter Libby. Libby was indicted 3 weeks ago on 5 counts of perjury, obstruction of justice, and making false statements. The indictment came down after Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald accused Libby of telling New York Times reporter Judy Miller about the identity of undercover CIA operative Valerie Plame and then lying to investigators about what happened. Plame's the wife of former U.S. Ambassador Joseph Wilson. The investigation had appeared to be slowing down until this week, but the investigation has taken a surprise turn. On Monday, Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald questioned Washington Post editor and best-selling author Bob Woodward for 2 hours. Until now, Woodward, who's best known for breaking the Watergate story, had no known role in the CIA leak case. He actually appeared frequently as a TV commentator downplaying the severity of the leak. At one point, he called Fitzgerald a, quote, junkyard dog prosecutor, and also claimed there was no criminal White House effort to out the CIA operative. But it turns out Woodward was a central figure in the story. He was told of Plame's identity 29 months ago, in June of 2003, before Miller or any other reporter. Woodward never reported this in the pages of the Washington Post and only mentioned it to his editors last month. The revelation raises new questions about the status of the investigation and whether Fitzgerald will seek any other indictments. Questions are also being raised about Woodward and his style of reporting. According to the Wall Street Journal, Woodward's been given unusual autonomy in the Washington Post newsroom as he writes a trilogy of books about the Bush administration. He's free to report for his numerous books, but he isn't obligated to share his scoops before the books are published. This has allowed him to sit on stories of national significance for months, even years. In this case, because Woodward concealed his own involvement, it's hindered his paper's ability to report fully on the leak investigation. Woodward's own editor, Leonard Downey, has admitted Woodward's in a special situation. Downey said, quote, it does require managing because of a lot of his reporting is done under confidential agreements like this particular one in which the interviews are for publication of a book rather than for the newspaper in a short time frame. But criticism of Woodward is escalating even from his own colleagues. Veteran staff writer Jonathan Yardley posted a message about Woodward on the Washington Post's confidential internal memo. He said, quote, "This is the logical and perhaps inevitable outcome when an institution permits an individual to become larger than the institution itself." To talk about this, we're joined by Steve Clements, editor of the popular news blog, thewashingtonnote.com, and a senior fellow at the New America Foundation. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Great to be with you, Amy.
Well, why don't you lay out for us this latest development with Patrick Fitzgerald now questioning Bob Woodward for 2 hours on Monday?
Well, Bob Woodward really, you know, rolled a very big bowling ball into the Fitzgerald investigation on the Valerie Plame leak. We know Woodward is in part telling the truth because it was not Woodward who created this theater. There was a U.S. official who triggered this to Fitzgerald, and I'm sure he's going to have a lot of questions. What really ought to anger the American public, and which makes me very, very frustrated with Bob Woodward, is not just that he is right, you know, that he knew all along that he was a material witness in this case, but was his outrageous commentary about the case earlier and his defense of a source. You have to understand, Bob Woodward said on Larry King that he thought that this was a small-time deal, that as you said, he called Patrick Fitzgerald a junkyard investigator and that this will disappear over time. And if this was casual conversation that he was having with someone offline in some minor casual way, why in the world would he be defending in a very serious way that source? If he looked at it as a casual issue, it makes no sense at all, unless Bob Woodward is trying to play a sort of Judy Miller type role of building up his own importance in something. So his own confession about this doesn't make sense. And secondly, for anyone to have gone on to Larry King and made the comments that Bob Woodward did while privately knowing that he was a very key material witness to what was going on, and he should have recused himself from any commentary, is an outrageous thing for a journalist. I think he's become a, you know, very self-intoxicated, deluded commentator on these things who's taken with his own importance, and he's forgotten his journalistic responsibility to the American public.
Now, explain the timeline of June. What now is the new picture that is beginning to unfold here?
Well, the important thing is that in the third week of June, I don't have the dates in front of me, but the third week of June, when Patrick Fitzgerald laid out a story that Scooter Libby, Louis Libby, Vice President Cheney's chief of staff, sewed together a story in which he tried to obfuscate the fact that he was the original source of information to any news media. And in his interactions with Matt Cooper, with Judy Miller, and with others, he attempted to create a circle where it made it look like the material that he had received from other media was what he was reporting to others, and he was just a middleman in the process. Patrick Fitzgerald very compellingly made the case, I thought, the day that he spoke, that when you look at the line of information, it showed that Scooter Libby was the original source of information. What Bob Woodward has just come out with is that story can no longer be true. If Woodward was notified about Valerie Plame's CIA covert status by another senior administration official before Libby had those conversations with Matt Cooper and Judy Miller, then there's a third official out there, other than Karl Rove and other than Scooter Libby, who made, if Bob Woodward wasn't the first person to know, but at least it preceded the history that Fitzgerald shared with us when he issued his indictments a few weeks ago. So What we're working with is we now have an interaction between the administration and another very important journalist that we know nothing about. So it's completely shrouded until either Len Downey compels Bob Woodward to be more forthcoming with the public. And you know, you have to understand what I found interesting is Matt Cooper of Time Magazine, when they lost the legal battle over keeping Matt Cooper's notes and knowledge quiet, they came forward. He told his whole story. And I think Woodward needs to do the same or suffer some consequences from the Washington Post.
Let's talk about Bob Woodward's source. Apparently didn't reveal it to Patrick
right.
Fitzgerald, and that was the agreement under which he would testify.
Well, I don't know who his source is. A lot of people are speculating it was Stephen Hadley. I'm in Dubuque, Iowa today, speaking out here on foreign policy issues, and did a scan of the media, as I'm sure many of your listeners and you have. And it seems that Hadley, while he
Stephen Hadley, the National Security Advisor.
Yeah, he has not denied being the source, but he's hinting that he is not the source. You know, you go back to that time, and you realize that one of the really interesting things about Bob Woodward, do you know Bob? Amy, do you know Bob Woodward?
No, I don't.
Bob Woodward
not personally.
Is an interesting kind of journalist and reporter. He, you know, another key reporter in this is Bob Novak. And what I tell people, and I've met both of them, I know Novak slightly better, Novak will talk to anyone. He'll talk to the janitor. He'll talk to the chef in the kitchen. He is a real hardworking journalist. You might not like what he writes, but he is not a snob when it comes to who he'll gather information or material from. Bob Woodward is a classic celebrity journalist snob who will only talk to the creme de la creme players. And his books are indicative of that. He's not someone, you know, Seymour Hersh works, contacts very well, works at all levels. So we know that Woodward's source is a very, very high administration official just by the normal footprint of his investigative work for other books and articles. So, I'm sorry?
I didn't say anything.
Oh, okay. So, you know, what we probably know at that time is that, you know, Condi Rice was National Security Advisor. Steve Hadley was the deputy at the time. So you had Condi over there, that's a potential option. Her name has never been mentioned in this, and I wouldn't mention it either. Vice President Cheney is someone who spoke to to Bob Woodward quite a bit. And so there are you know, questions. We don't know who it is, but we know that it's probably someone very, very high up in the White House. And while speculation is that it's Hadley thus far, he's not confessed, he's not come forward, which, if it turns out to be Hadley, is quite cowardly.
We're talking to Stephen Clements, publisher of WashingtonNote.com, senior fellow at the New America Foundation, co-directs the American Strategy Program, and is also director of the Japan-America Society of Southern California, co-founded the Japan Policy Research Institute with Chalmers Johnson. After the break, I want to quickly ask you about the significance of President Bush's Asia visit.
Sure.
But still on Bob Woodward and where this takes this investigation. What does this mean for Scooter Libby?
Well, what it means for Scooter Libby is that while it doesn't materially change the charges of false statements and perjury, those still stand just based on the evidence that Patrick Fitzgerald brought forward. What does change quite a bit is the political significance of Libby's comments that you know, despite not being charged with the higher charges of actively, you know, violating the Intelligence Identities Protection Act, which was the most serious crime which Fitzgerald is investigating, it changes the dynamics quite a bit because it takes a lot of pressure off Libby, and it makes him look like his biggest crime was that he lied a couple of times, and that, in fact, he was not the one who spun this entire story. There, it could go another way. Another way it might go is, depending on who this other official was, if there was any coordination between Libby and this other individual, of course we don't know that to be the case, then there's the possibility of conspiracy-type charges coming forward. But I think Fitzgerald was really caught out of left field and didn't see this coming. And because the rest of this story was not part of Fitzgerald's narrative, I think we just all have to wait and see what Fitzgerald now learns.
And finally, President Bush's Asia trip.
Well, President Bush is trying to do a lot of things right now to distract the American public from questions about Iraq, the WMD, intelligence abuse questions, the detainee abuse issues, you know, the questions about Vice President Cheney's attempts to get the CIA exempted from torture, and the failure on the Harriet Myers things. He's been trying to do a lot of things that are distractions. And this Asia trip, while part of the APEC Leaders Summit, and this year hosted in Korea, is he's been using to to chastise China on various fronts and make some news by basically talking about democracy in China, which is not entirely a bad thing. But he's off trying to show himself as a world leader, doing what world leaders do, which is talking about big problems in other places and hoping that America, you know, gives him some credit for that, because his popularity and his approval ratings are plummeting right now.
Steve Clemens, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Publisher of the blog, thewashingtonnote.com, senior fellow at the New America Foundation. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. This week has been one of anti-Walmart activism around the country. A new film has come out called Walmart, The High Price of Low Cost. But there's also been a new film that's come out in favor of Walmart. Today we'll play excerpts of those films and then we'll have a debate. Stay with us.
You have turned into a prayer. I can feel I'm almost there.
Let me have it all. Sly and the Family Stone here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Thursday, more than 120 workers were arrested in a raid by Immigrations and Custom Enforcement agents in Butler Township, Pennsylvania. The raid took place at the construction site of a million-square-foot Walmart distribution center. Walmart has blamed a subcontractor for hiring the undocumented workers, but critics of Walmart, the world's largest retailer, say that this is standard fare for a company that tries to cut corners in order to lower its costs and expand its profit. Paul Blank, campaign director of WakeUpWalmart.com, said, quote, "They're trying to improve their public image, but they're undermining their own attempts. There's clearly a pattern where they're violating the law," he said. In March, Walmart agreed to pay an $11 million settlement after immigration agents raided 60 stores and arrested 245 people working illegally. Last month, the New York Times obtained an internal Walmart memo that proposed the company curtail spending on employee benefits while minimizing damage to its public image. The Times reports the recommendations, including hiring more part-time workers, reducing retirement contributions, and discouraging unhealthy people from applying for positions. The memo also acknowledged the company's already in a delicate position because 46% of the children of Walmart employees are uninsured or on Medicaid. Walmart's labor practices are also criticized in a new documentary released this month entitled Walmart, The High Cost of Low Price. It's produced by Robert Greenwald. To combat this wave of negative publicity, the New York Times reports Walmart has set up a public relations war room staffed with former Republican and Democratic presidential advisors. The Times writes, quote, "When small business owners or union officials criticize the company, the war room swings into action with press releases, phone calls to reporters, and instant web postings." The Times reports the war room was set up as part of a larger Walmart effort to portray itself as more worker-friendly and environmentally conscious company. Today, we're going to have a debate over Walmart, and we'll also air excerpts from two films, the Greenwald film, as well as the documentary Why Walmart Works and Why That Makes Some People Crazy. It's by Ron and Robert Galloway. We're going to turn now to that first film.
we always hear these things about the benefits and things like that. First time I went to the doctor, to the dentist, I actually got my teeth cleaned. I've never done that before, you know what I mean? And to actually be able to go to a doctor when I'm sick right then, you know, and I don't have to wait 6 hours to be seen because I'm sitting in a county facility.
Walmart gets a bad rap because it only pays about $3,500 per employee for health benefits. Now, a lot of companies will pay more, a lot of companies pay less. But if you look at the average for all employers, for family coverage, it's about almost $7,000. And if you look at the average for all employers for individual workers, self-only coverage, it's about $2,800. So actually, Walmart is somewhere, their average is somewhere in between there. But if you look at retail companies, they actually pay a lot less in general than the average employer. So Walmart's package looks even more reasonable there. And Walmart makes the point that one of the reasons why they pay less in health benefits is because they get more effective health benefits.
There is very little evidence to support Walmart corporate telling its workers, go out, do not take our insurance plan. Take the insurance plan offered by a state government, by a federal agency. There's just no evidence that Walmart corporate has done that. There are many instances, of local store managers and other lower level managers saying to their employees, it's a better deal for you. Go ahead, go do it. There are some notices that various opponents have found.
That is the most disingenuous and least meritorious charge against Walmart, because it's coming from the very people who are trying to expand Medicaid and get more people on to government health programs. If you look at the people who are criticizing Walmart, they're also trying to get middle-class families onto these government programs. And a few words about these government programs. Medicaid provides lower quality health coverage to a lot of people than they would get with private coverage. The government has been expanding Medicaid up the income scale so that now in a lot of states, middle-class people can get on these government health programs. And one of the effects of Medicaid and other government health programs is that they make private insurance more expensive. Now, you put all these factors together, and then you look at the fact that the people who are promoting government health programs are criticizing Walmart because Walmart employees are taking advantage of these programs, it's completely disingenuous. If the government is giving health coverage away for free, how can Walmart compete with that? If the government is selling if you're selling apples on one side of the street and the government moves in on the other side of the street, starts giving away apples for free, and then the government starts criticizing you because people aren't buying your apples anymore, I mean, how ridiculous is that?
That the pro-Walmart film that has just been produced, we now turn to the anti-Walmart film, which begins with Walmart employee Josh Noble describing his insurance plan at Walmart.
I was under my mom's insurance plan with a local grocery store that she works for, and any prescription it didn't matter what it was $5. And now through Walmart, for that one bottle of pills, I'm paying $70.
But I can't afford to put my children on the Walmart shirt because it's too expensive.
There's no way I can afford to have $75 taken out of each check just for medical. That's why, because I'm such low income, I am able to get the Medicaid for the kids through Colorado State.
But they're a $1 billion corporation, so I don't see why they cannot offer a better medical package for their associates so that we can afford to get our families on insurance.
You start weighing, okay, he's sick, we eat. Which one do we do? Well, let's give him an aspirin.
No matter what anybody says, or at poverty level, I watch so many people go without lunch in the lounges that I stopped eating in the lounges because I just had my managers eating there because I just couldn't stand it. They just wouldn't eat, and we weren't allowed to offer them any money. And there were people I see that didn't eat nothing. They'd take an hour lunch and just sat there.
We have full-time employees that worked at Walmart, and they had medical. But the medical was so high, so they had to go out and get Medi-Cal, some type of government medical.
While I was working at Walmart, I was on WIC. It's an excellent program. It saved my life, really. because you got all the formula and cereal and stuff you needed for the baby. And I also went to the Medicaid office. It can be a real hassle having to deal with the offices, but, you know, at least they're there. I'm thankful for the programs that are available, you know. It's not a fun situation. It's demeaning. I always heard people say, you know, oh, they're just, you know, there's so many people who just use the system, use it. I can't imagine that, because there is no way I would want to spend any length of time having to do what you have to do to get assistance.
You talk about using the system. Look at the way Walmart is using the system. They're promoting people to go to Healthy Kids and to get food stamps and Section 8 housing, and they're the ones that are using the system.
Yeah, it's pretty bad when you need to tell your employees that all these programs are available for you, because we're not paying you enough money.
Retail giant Walmart is encouraging its workers to go on welfare.
Instead of paying for its employees to have health benefits, she says Walmart is making the government take care of it.
In Florida, Walmart has more employees and family members eligible for Medicaid than any other company. Critics accuse the retail giant of using Medicaid and state programs for the poor as its health care plan.
This report from UC Berkeley researchers concludes Walmart costs state taxpayers $86 million a year and county taxpayers as much as another $25 million to pick up the tab for public health care, income tax credits, housing subsidies, and food stamps.
Evelyn Dees used to work full-time for Walmart, but didn't have company health care benefits. She literally couldn't afford to pay for it, so she turned to government assistance.
What the public doesn't understand is that those everyday low prices are based on taxpayer subsidies. Walmart is getting away with it because they can.
I talked to the regional personnel manager about who was going to take care of the Walmart associates and their health care needs, and he said, let the state do it.
The personnel manager told me personally that there's assistance out there for people. They should be able to go use it. Use your taxpayers' dollars.
I had a list of all of the government agencies and all the different places that people could go if they needed money for their utility bills, if they needed to apply for food stamps, or if they needed to apply for WIC or for Medicaid.
So your dignity is not there. Your pride is not there. You go to work knowing that you're not making enough money to really make ends meet, but yet you got to go with a smile on your face and fake it. Yeah, that's pretty bad.
Come up with some type of health care that a full-time person can afford and don't have to put on the scale health care or feed my family.
Why is it that a corporation that in 2003 had an outstanding $240 billion in sales would not provide a livable wage and affordable health care for their employees?
There's nowhere around that there's a company that makes this much money and still turns around and makes their associates go to the state for aid.
An excerpt of Walmart, the high cost of low price. We're joined in the Washington studio by Tracy Seffel, communications director, Walmart Watch. Joining us on the telephone from Georgia is Ron Galloway, the documentary filmmaker who produced Why Walmart Works and Why That Drives Some People Crazy. Well, let's start with Ron Galloway. Why did you make your film, and what is your response to these concerns about Walmart and its treatment of its workers?
Good morning, Amy.
It's good to have you with us.
I'm not an Amy head yet, but I'm willing to learn. Basically, I made the film initially as a study of logistics, but it turned into more of a study of people. And if I could address pretty much the main thrust of the clips before about Walmart putting people on government assistance or recommending government assistance, and that causing costing the taxpayers money. There's a flip side to that. Walmart pays $22 billion. Let's accept the number that is bandied about, which is that Walmart costs taxpayers between $1.5 billion and $2 billion. Well, let's accept that. But Walmart pays $22 billion in federal taxes, collects $11 billion in state and local taxes, And through their vendors, and this is sort of the unrecognized story, their vendor suppliers, they also are responsible for another $40 billion in income tax. Walmart is a complete cash cow, so if you add those three up, that's $73 billion. So sort of a flip side of looking at it is if Walmart is paying or costing $2 billion, $73 billion is coming back into the Treasury. Now, I'm a middle-aged guy, and as with most things, you find that the truth lies somewhere in the middle. But I honestly don't believe things are as dire as they are portrayed in the other film.
Tracy Seffel, Communications Director, Walmart Watch in Washington, your response?
Hi, thank you, Amy. First of all, I think Mr. Galloway is doing something that must be a little bit lonely. He's certainly on the wrong side of the equation these days. All around the country this week, we've been screening the Walmart high cost of low price to hundreds of thousands of people across the country, screenings of big and small in private homes, in public theaters, in public parks, huge crowds. It's been an incredible week, and we're delighted to know just how far-reaching this film has been. And what's notable about the film are the key arguments that are made in it, which we think reflect all of the concerns of our organization and those who support us. And the first is certainly this notion of healthcare and the crisis that Walmart is contributing to in this country. By not paying affordable wages and by not offering adequate benefits, this company is indisputably pushing people into a difficult position of having to rely on public programs. Imagine just for a moment, if this were the Microsoft Corporation and it was Bill Gates' company where you heard these same kind of stories, the responsibility for this shameful business practice lies squarely on the shoulders of the Walton family, the multi-mega billionaires who control this company and who make the final decisions in the private confines of their boardroom. That's where the responsibility lies. That's where the problems can be diagnosed to. So the healthcare crisis is certainly the first and most foremost pressing issue that we've been attending to. The memo that you mentioned earlier was leaked to our organization several weeks ago. We were stunned by what was in there. We were also stunned by the fact that this was the company acknowledging in their own words and to the privacy of their board of directors just how bad that problem is. So while we're delighted that there's a film that's making that argument, we also continually like to note that it was the Walmart Corporation, in their own words, acknowledging just how bad it is as well.
Tracy Seffel, was it your group, Walmart Watch, that got a hold of this internal memo about healthcare?
Yes, it came to our office in an unmarked, plain envelope, no return address. We don't know who sent it to us. We've received several other similar documents from inside the company, which to us suggests that there's not only an internal security problem at Walmart, but that there are people high up inside the company who agree that there are serious problems that need to be attended to, that this is a flawed business model, and that this is a company that is essentially profiting on the backs of its lowest paid workers.
Now, among other things in the memo, it said that it would have people start off by pushing carts, even if that wouldn't be their job, but just to weed out unhealthy people who might not be able to do that, to keep the health care costs lower?
That was, in fact, one page, one part of the memo. And while there were many pieces of this memo that many would argue were simply reflections of the realities of corporate America and the importance of understanding a bottom line and looking at benefits and looking at value and value-added benefits, there was a tone to this memo that was so disturbing and so profoundly troubling that it explains the impact that this memo has had on the debate about Walmart in this country.
Ron Galloway, were you troubled by this memo?
Well, yeah, it was kind of a boneheaded memo, and the person that wrote it, they immediately put out on the air to get a good whipping on a lot of media organizations. I'm not sure that that represents the full view of Walmart corporate, but that was clearly a suboptimal memo. Now, one thing, she talked about Microsoft there for a second. Microsoft has 43% profit margins, whereas Walmart has 3.5%. And so where Walmart does make or generate $250 million in revenues, they make $9 billion. Well, $9 billion still sounds like a lot, but they are running things really skinny over there. And the two big things they have to worry about or wages and health care. For instance, if everybody got a $4 an hour raise at Walmart, that $9 billion would be erased. They operate on such a scale and so skinny that they just they're walking a thin line. And Tracy also said that Walmart has a flawed business model. Well, I would contend that 138 million people a week accept that flawed business model and walk into their stores, and 1.3 million people work there. And you know, we're pretty close. We're statistically around a full employment economy, so it's not like they don't have other choices. And for unskilled labor, I firmly believe that, ironically, due to Walmart's growth, for unskilled labor at Walmart, it's really one of the better places where you can move up. I can't think of another corporation where just because they grow so fast, they have to hire from within.
Ron Galloway,
I can't really think of any place else you can do that.
We'll go back to that point, but we have to break four stations to identify themselves. Ron Galloway is the producer of the film Why Walmart Works, and Tracy Seffel is communications director of Walmart Watch. We'll be back with them in a minute.
Com palmos medida, é a conta menor que tiraste em vida. É a conta menor que tiraste em vida. É de bom tamanho, nem largo nem fundo. É a parte que te cabe nesse latifúndio. É a parte que te cabe nesse latifúndio. Não é cova grande, é cova medida. É a terra que querias ver dividida. É a terra que querias ver dividida. É uma cova grande pra teu pouco defunto. Mas estarás mais ancho que estavas no mundo. Mas estarás mais ancho que estavas no mundo. É uma cova grande pra teu defunto barco. Porém mais que no mundo te sentirás largo. Porém mais que no mundo te sentirás largo. É uma cova grande pra tua carne pouca. Mas a terra dada não se abre a boca. Mas a terra dada não se abre a boca. Mas a terra dada não se abre a boca. Mas a terra dada não se abre a boca. Mas a terra dada não se abre a boca. É a parte que te cabe nesse latifúndio. É a terra que querias ver dividida.
Funeral of a Laborer, Zelia Barbosa here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. Our guests are Ron Galloway, documentary filmmaker, made Why Walmart Works and Why That Drives Some People Crazy. Also in the Washington studio, Tracy Seffel, communications director of Walmart Watch. Tracy Seffel, your response about the ability of workers to be promoted from within. And then I wanted to go to the issue of Walmart's public image and how they're dealing with it, with this war room. The New York Times reporting about how Walmart has taken a page from the modern political playbook, has quietly recruited former presidential advisors, including Michael Deaver, who was Ronald Reagan's image meister, and Leslie, is it Dach, D-A-C-H, one of Bill Clinton's media consultants, to set up this rapid response PR team, a war room in Arkansas. Tracy Seffel.
The question about mobility is an important one, especially in the context of this post-Katrina time. We all know, of course, Walmart came out and outshone the Bush administration in its response to the natural disaster. I'm not saying that it was much of a stretch to outshine the Bush administration, but nonetheless, it was an important moment for Walmart. They commanded tremendous press. They did good work. They helped people at a time of crisis. All of that seems to have been past and forgotten now, and Walmart hasn't been able to capture anything beyond that instant moment where it came to the rescue of some people in a quick time. And the important point here is that the notion of mobility and opportunity should be something that a corporation embraces. I'd like to point out something that's been little noticed, back to the memo you were discussing earlier. There are actually two versions of that memo. The original version, which is available on my website at walmartwatch.com, is different than the memo that the company ultimately provided to the New York Times. And there's one section that the company actually omitted in the version that they made public. And that section talks about how their associates, when overcome with health care costs and problems that arise from their health care crises, that associates are forced to file for bankruptcy, and they offer the troubling statistics about just how many of their associates have been forced into bankruptcy. That version was omitted from the memo that they made public. Now, what kind of mobility is being offered? What kind of opportunities is a company offering when it has to make private discussions about just how many of their associates are forced into bankruptcy? What kind of a circumstance is that? What kind of a corporate model is that to look up to? And why wouldn't they have left that in the document that they made public?
Ron Galloway, let's put that question right to you.
Well, I guess the first thing I would say is statistically, Walmart is so huge that I think they have to address the problem. I didn't know about that part being left out, but I'll say this on Walmart's whole PR I guess problem is one problem they would have is she mentioned Katrina. Well, Walmart actually didn't really go out and advertise much after that or brag about it, where they had a golden opportunity. The other interesting thing is lately I've sort of been defending Walmart a whole bunch, and when they have Forrest Gump out there defending them, then they may need some PR straightening out to do. And I think that's one of their problems. They're so focused on their mission, which is, of course, always low prices, that I think they feel or have felt as though that if they were doing that, that was good enough and people would recognize it. But we live in a really political world now, and I just think that's not good enough anymore. And they are making attempts at ameliorating their PR problem.
Amy, I think that
Tracy Seffel of Walmart Watch.
Sure. The so-called war room that Walmart has been gaining attention for having convened has essentially served two functions for that company. First, it's gotten them attention merely for having it. It's not clear to me that this has been an operation that has been successful in helping the company out of its unfortunate bind and morass of bad publicity and terrible missteps. Today, the headline you led with, and 120 illegal undocumented workers rounded up at a Walmart construction site, these aren't good times for the company. Perhaps these well or overpaid consultants should focus a little more on coming up with solutions and less on simply publicizing their own existence. The second point I would mention is that this so-called war room has actually done a terrific job to bring more attention to Mr. Greenwald's film and to help drive huge crowds all over the country this week. In fact, all over the world. Just last weekend, we learned that there is a screening of the movie occurring down in Antarctica. This has been a tremendous thing, and we're thankful that the Walmart Corporation, by choosing to issue somewhat baseless attacks on Mr. Greenwald, has actually helped publicize the movie even more. So those are the two things that this war room has seemed to actually accomplish at this point.
Ron Galloway.
Amy, could I say...
Yes.
Could I say one thing about the other film real quick? And this is kind of an aside. One of the producers of the other film, Jim Gilliam, is awaiting a... And I know you have a lot of listeners, Amy. He's awaiting a lung transplant at UCLA. And I think it would be kind of a good thing for your listeners to sort of send a thought his way. He's supposed to find out pretty soon. Now, that's an aside. And, you know, business is business. But I think the whole war room issue... I think, I'm not sure if I was Walmart, I would have publicized that either, but I think it's sort of one of their first attempts to kind of deal with the, and Tracy's over there in Washington, it's their, one of their first sort of attempts to try and deal with operating on a level that Washington operates at. I mean, they're in Arkansas, and I think they're learning, but, I truly believe this, and Walmart, I genuinely believe, does more for poor and blue-collar workers in this country than any special interest group does. So you have to take the good with the bad. But and like everything else, I've said it before, the truth lies somewhere in the middle of my film and Mr. Greenwald's film. But Walmart genuinely serves the poor more than almost any other institution except the government.
Well, Tracy Seffel, what about that point?
What Walmart does by its inadequate wages, its low benefits, its disdain for communities, its disregard of the democratic political process, essentially, it's making another class of Walmart customers. They're ensuring their own success by virtue of their business model. That's the bottom line with this company.
Amy, could I say one thing?
Yes, Ron Galloway.
Walmart doesn't have 138 million employees that go there every week. So I think people vote with their feet. And Walmart is just so big that they set the statistical mean. They are the mean. So they're going to have every issue you can think of to deal with. These undocumented workers this morning, by the way, were hired by a subcontractor who was contractually bound to Walmart not to hire undocumented workers. Personally, I think we should be able to hire as many undocumented workers as we want. If we're going to let them into the country, I think they should be able to work. So I sort of have bleeding heart.
Tracy Seffel,
look on that one.
Let me ask you, what is Walmart Watch's goal?
This week and beyond, our goal is for Walmart to do three things: to become a better employer, a better neighbor, and a better corporate citizen. We've talked extensively about their employment practices, and I think it's very clear that there's certainly room for this company to change. They've made tiny little steps in a direction that we think is good. They have a long way to go. We also expect Walmart to become a better neighbor. This is a corporation that has little disregard for local democratic processes. It steamrolls over local communities. It lies and badgers and baits and switches its way into local towns. Just this week, my organization released yet another leaked document that shows exactly where Walmart is planning to expand itself in the coming year. And that's been tremendous fodder for all of these energized supporters around the country to say, well, now we know where this company is planning to come, and we'll be there to fight it and to make sure that it happens on our terms if we decide it should happen.
I want to ask you both about China, the relationship between China and Walmart. Tracy Seffel, I'll start with you.
Sam Walton was heralded for his Buy America program, for bringing to the forefront of American retail and American manufacturing a commitment to selling products that were made in this country. That's long gone. It's nothing more than a shadow of itself at this point. The company has abandoned that philosophy. 70% of the merchandise on Walmart's shelves are from China. We featured an advertisement recently, and I do believe that's available on our website as well, that features a photograph from an actual Walmart store here in the Washington area, with arrows pointing to every item that's from China. Needless to say, the photo is filled with arrows. The point here is that that comes at the expense of American jobs. It comes at the expense of American jobs, and it comes with the abandonment of Sam Walton's philosophy. This isn't the same company that it once was.
Ron Galloway, your response.
Well, 100 years ago, as is stated in my film, Europeans were screaming and moaning about the fact of the flood of cheap goods from America. Walmart is simply, there's winners and losers in this. You can't argue that. The winners are the American consumer and the Chinese laborer. The loser is certain sectors of the American manufacturing economy. Now, Walmart didn't make the rules that allow this flood of imports to come in. I happen to think those rules are, as I stated before, suboptimal. But they didn't set those rules. They're simply following them. China actually represents one of the great growth opportunities for Walmart in terms of putting stores there. But there's no way around the fact that that the American worker in certain manufacturing sectors has been left behind, and I don't see the government or much of anybody really addressing that problem.
Ron Galloway, we have to leave it there. Tracy Seffel as well. Ron Galloway has made the film with his brother, Why Walmart Works and Why That Drives Some People Crazy. Tracy Seffel with Walmart Watch. The excerpt of the film we played was Walmart, the High Cost of Low Price. And that does it for today's broadcast. You want to go to our website. You can read the transcripts. You can hear the audio. You can watch the video. That's democracynow.org. And you can also sign up there for our headlines. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Maddie Harper, Susie Salami. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Again, our website is democracynow.org. We podcast there both video and audio. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us for another edition. of Democracy Now!